This is the Late Round Podcast with your host, JJ Zacharisa. JJ Zacharisa.
What's up, everyone? It's JJ Zacharyson, the editor-in-chief at FanDuel and at NumberFire.com, and this is episode 191 of the Late Round Podcast, one of the many shows that are part of the NumberFire Podcast Network. Thanks for tuning in. After Le'Veon Bell failed to show up this week, we had takes. Social media was filled with Le'Veon Bell contract takes. By now, you guys probably know mine. To maximize the amount of money that Bell was going to make, it made sense for him to play this year and then get a new contract next year. Yes, I understand that he could have gotten hurt. I understand the Steelers could have run him into the ground. But an injury was not a guarantee, and a career-altering injury was definitely not a guarantee. And Bell sitting out sort of showed us that his production was replaceable in the Steelers' offense. And it's funny, when I say that, I'm always met with the response of, well, James Conner's really good, so that's not entirely true. I mean, James Conner was also drafted with a third-round compensatory pick. And not only is James Conner technically outproducing Le'Veon Bell, but this isn't the first time this has happened in the Pittsburgh offense. D'Angelo Williams at 32 years old was pretty strong in the Steelers offense with Bell sidelined as well. Eventually, you have to think that it's the situation that matters for running backs and not simply the player. This is precisely why Saquon Barkley ranks 33rd of the 53 running backs with 50 or more carries this year in success rate. Guys, Saquon Barkley is a freaking monster. He's a freak. But without additional pieces in that offense, without a strong line and a competent quarterback, running backs aren't able to truly showcase their skill set. Elite running backs are a luxury. They're not a necessity. As I wrote this offseason in a study that I did on running back value, it's not that running backs can't matter, it's that it's hard for them to matter consistently. And it's because so much can change in the NFL from one season to the next. It's hard to consistently have good offensive line play. It's hard to consistently have smart coaching. And anytime those two things change, the running game is impacted. If you take the team per play expected point numbers on the ground and through the air over the last 15 years, the year-over-year R-squared values are drastically different. Let me quickly explain what I mean before sharing those numbers. At NumberFire, as a lot of you guys know, we have an expected points model. Ours is unique in that it's calculated in a unique way, but expected point models are everywhere and rarely have radically different results. Within our expected points model, which is called net expected points, we've got team measurements. We can see how well both teams and players are performing from an expected points standpoint. And at the team level, we adjust for strength of opponent to allow for more of a level playing field. Looking at the per play numbers over the last 15 seasons, passing efficiency has a year-over-year R-squared value of about 0.25. In football, that's actually not that bad. In any other industry, a correlation that weak is not all that meaningful. But what's interesting is that the R-squared value in rushing efficiency year-over-year is 0.04. It's essentially non-existent. In other words, the way a rushing attack performs this year doesn't tell us a whole lot about how it's going to perform next year. And that's pretty telling. It's showing us that even if a team has Le'Veon Bell, or a David Johnson, or a Todd Gurley, or a Saquon Barkley, that those teams' rushing attacks aren't likely to be consistently efficient year-over-year. And then with passing, we see more consistency. I do think there's a few things that need to be understood here so that someone who's tilting while listening to this doesn't take things to the extreme. First off, some of this has to do with the fact that play callers have not been effective. A team with Sean McVay is going to be able to extract better efficiency than a team with Mike McCoy. Sean McVay understands football in the year 2018. Mike McCoy doesn't. And we're also not capturing absolutely everything here. Obviously, running backs catch footballs as well. Obviously, running backs do other things than just run the football. I did talk about those other things in my off-season study, but I'm not sitting here pretending that a simple correlation test tells us everything we need to know about running the football at the NFL level. But I think it's good evidence, and I think it's a simple way of showing the importance of passing over rushing. And honestly, from a fantasy perspective, it's a good reason for us to fade efficiency and continue to focus on volume when we're forecasting an upcoming season. Now, some team will probably give Le'Veon Bell a nice contract, and for Bell's sake, I hope it's a lucrative one. That's the thing. Saying that Bell should have played the entire season doesn't mean that I'm not siding with Le'Veon Bell in the contract dispute. I want players to get the most money that they can get. But that's also the point. To get the most money, Bell should have just played from the start. But we're past that now. We're now at the point where we're trying to guess where Le'Veon Bell is going to end up. And unfortunately, if a team is willing to give a 27-year-old running back who hasn't played football for well over a year while completely being replaced in his offense and one that's had past suspensions, if that team is willing to give that player a big contract, then you've got to think they don't really have the pieces for him to thrive. But time will tell. On this podcast specifically, it's time to officially move past the topic until that time comes. Before answering this week's questions, because this is a mailbag episode, I wanted to remind you guys about the weekly NumberFire Podcast Network free roll over on FanDuel. In last week's free roll, it was MANDM1122 taking home the top prize with a score of 192.5. They had Drew Brees stacked with Michael Thomas, while also getting big performances from David Johnson, Aaron Jones, Melvin Gordon, and Corey Davis. If you want to play in this week's NumberFire free roll and get a chance at NumberFire premium memberships and free FanDuel points, go to FanDuel.com/league/gym. That's FanDuel.com/league/JIM. This first question is from @DSchmelzerFS. Are there any specific offenses or passing attacks that we should be looking to add for the playoffs? Yeah, so I sort of talked about these passing offenses in my 15 transactions episodes over the last couple of weeks. But I think you can target Carolina, Pittsburgh, Chicago, and Houston. Carolina faces Cleveland, New Orleans, and Atlanta from weeks 14 through 16. Pittsburgh gets Oakland, New England, and New Orleans. Chicago gets the Rams, Packers, and 49ers, and two of those games are at home. And Houston's a little interesting against the Colts, Jets, and Eagles. The Steelers and Panthers specifically have really awesome schedules. This next question is from @hose_2_the_a. Would you trade Todd Gurley? Have Breida, Aaron Jones, Kerryon, Marlon Mack, and Mike Davis. Need help at wide receiver. Gurley has a week 12 bye, and I'm in the midst of playoff contention. Concerned about the Rams being 9-1 and maybe resting him at the end of the season. Thoughts? So I'm not overly concerned with the Rams resting Gurley because the Saints also only have one loss in the NFC. Now, a lot can change between now and when the fantasy playoffs start, but I would think the Rams still want to try to lock up home field advantage. And the Saints did beat them head-to-head. I'd also have a hard time trading Todd Gurley. I can understand it a little bit if you were getting a Melvin Gordon type back in return with another really good piece at wide receiver, since Gurley does have that week 12 bye, but there's not a wide receiver that I would take in a deal for Gurley that would make it a worthwhile trade-off. Todd Gurley is just that dominant. This next question is from @SippinAndDrivin. Could a Cooper and Prescott stack win people leagues? Favorable schedule coming up. I mentioned this on my matchup show this week, but I'm liking what we're seeing from Amari Cooper so far. I thought he'd be more of a wide receiver 3 in that offense, but he's sort of looking like a wide receiver 2. He's seeing 26.5% of Dak Prescott's attempts, so if that keeps up, he's going to be plenty usable in fantasy football. And I do like their week 15 and 16 matchups against the Colts and the Bucks. Those are great matchups for both players. I don't want to call them league winners because I'm not sure the passing offense itself is capable of posting out of control numbers for multiple weeks, but I do think they're great players to have on your roster and potentially in your lineup during that time, especially with Dak doing a little bit more with his legs of late. This next question is from @BJHorvat14. What are your thoughts on trades with teams out of playoff contention? The commish, who's in the hunt, traded Mike Davis for Russell Wilson, who's out of the hunt. Bad fantasy etiquette or veto worthy? They play each other next week, the last one before the playoffs. Okay, so first off, I'm recording the show before the Thursday night football game, and I really don't want to have to edit anything out because something happens to Russell Wilson or Mike Davis or something. So just know that it's currently Thursday afternoon, and I have zero idea what's going to happen in the Thursday night game. But no, this is definitely not a veto-worthy trade. Quarterback is a replaceable position in fantasy football, and maybe the person getting Mike Davis sees upside with him. Or maybe they're just not confident in Chris Carson's ability to stay on the field. I don't think the trade is all that egregious. We're not talking Mike Davis for Todd Gurley. Maybe it's bad fantasy etiquette, but you can't veto something like this. And my thoughts on trades with teams out of playoff contention are that they're fine because you're still playing within the rules. If you're worried about bad trades going down, your commissioner should find ways to avoid that from happening. Maybe there's a weekly payout for teams. Maybe the last place team has to do something at the end of the season. There are ways to encourage teams to keep trying, even if they're not going to make the playoffs. If the rules say that any team can trade with any other team, then any team should be able to. This next question kind of plays into the previous one. It's from @DavidRCoffin. In a keeper league, what, if any, restrictions do you think should be made on trades between teams that are in and out of playoff contention? So I had a situation in my home league a couple of years ago where someone who was out of the playoffs traded Ezekiel Elliott at the last minute for really mediocre keepers. We even have weekly payouts, but he valued the keepers a lot higher than pretty much every other manager in the league. The trade was annoying, but we still pushed it through because I'm not an ignorant commissioner. but it did force a league rule change where the trade deadline remained the same, but the keeper deadline was different. Meaning, if you trade for players after a particular date, they can't be kept. And we put that date as week 8, where teams still aren't sure if they're going to contend or not. So that's the best solution, I think, if you're worried about teams tanking at the very last minute while other teams are building powerhouses. This next one's from @FFAndy8. How do you feel about Emmanuel Sanders' rest of season? I'm worried his production will suffer with the loss of Demaryius Thomas and him spending less time in the slot. So the last time we saw Denver's offense, so back in week 9, Sanders had 9 targets and he played 57% of his snaps from the slot. That slot rate was slightly below his season average. And I do think the fear would be that they utilize Deshaun Hamilton there when he returns. But Sanders should still get a good amount of run there, I would assume, and we know that he's more than likely going to lead the Broncos in targets down the stretch. The main reason I would hold on to Emmanuel Sanders, though, is because in the playoffs, Denver gets San Francisco, Cleveland, and Oakland. He should be able to produce against those defenses. That's actually why Cortland Sutton was a buy in 15 transactions 2 weeks ago. So even if Sanders doesn't see as much work in the slot now that DT is gone, I'm still liking him rest of season. This next one's from @DrakeSal. Is it better to stash a defense with a favorable matchup in the upcoming weeks or stash a handcuff like Spencer Ware? I'll probably side with the handcuff here just because you can usually find a worthwhile defense on the waiver wire each week. But I think this also depends on what your waiver wire looks like. If it's filled with defenses, then it's not necessary to hold on to more than one of them. If there are limited options, or if you know that you're going to be stuck with complete crap, then you might have to take the risk and hold multiple defenses. Generally, though, when we're talking about high-end handcuffs this time of year, that's the direction that I would lean. There's just far more upside and far more downside if an injury happens to one of your backs and you don't have the insurance. This last question is from @DreSpinny. Given the atrocious offenses of the Bills, Cards, and others, has this season changed the way you view offensive play calling and coaching's impact on individual fantasy performances in general? So I think to first answer this question, I should note that all of my projections and the way that I look at players before a season starts begins at the team level. So I'm looking at how good the offense is going to be in general, because good fantasy assets usually come from good offenses. And that evaluation includes evaluating coaching. One of my bigger takeaways last year, and something that I talked about a lot on this podcast, was that a coach can dramatically change an offense. We saw that with Sean McVay. Now, he's an outlier example, but I still don't want to understate the impact a good coach and play caller can have. The problem is, you can't always predict that. I wasn't a huge Mike McCoy fan entering the season, but I still didn't think or assume that he'd be as bad as he was. But you can also make educated guesses as to which teams may struggle just by looking at personnel and, again, building out overall team projections. A big reason I preferred Todd Gurley and Le'Veon Bell at the beginning of the season to Zeke and David Johnson was because their offenses were going to be a lot better. And good offenses, or offenses with good personnel, are more forgiving than offenses with bad personnel. If you've got a bad coach and a good offense, sometimes it doesn't fully matter. It just means that there may not be as high of a ceiling. A good example of that is with Mike McCarthy and the Packers. We all believe the Packers should be better offensively with a smarter coach, but Aaron Rodgers, Davante Adams, and whoever else are all fine for fantasy purposes because they're good, and it's because they're being led by Aaron Rodgers. Meanwhile, with Arizona, not only did you have questionable quarterback play and a bad offensive line entering the year, but the coach ended up being horrible. So there was some risk naturally with David Johnson, but then that was made worse by Mike McCoy. I mean, don't get me wrong, David Johnson was still a fine pick in fantasy football because of volume. But drafting players in what are projected to be good offenses is most important, and you generally are judging good offenses by personnel. Coaching then can either enhance a player's ceiling or lower his floor. But it's going to be easier to project the former than the latter. It's going to be easier to say, this wide receiver has Aaron Rodgers, while this one has Sam Bradford, versus this wide receiver has Mike McCarthy, and this one has Mike McCoy, and then finding what that net impact is. It's just not easy to measure that sort of thing. I mean, the bottom line is that the teams that have been atrocious for fantasy purposes were kind of not looking great entering the season anyway. We don't have to look at the coaches to tell us that. It's not like the Bills are only bad offensively because Brian Daboll is a bad offensive coordinator. The Bills are bad offensively because they had a bad quarterback plan this year, they saw a big drop in offensive line personnel, and they have no wide receivers. This has really just been me sort of brain vomiting, and maybe the answer to this question doesn't make a ton of sense, and I apologize for that. But good and bad offenses are obviously not just the result of good and bad coaching. Personnel matters a ton. Coaching can then just get the most or least out of particular players. And every once in a while, you'll hit the jackpot with someone like Sean McVay, who can just completely turn an offense around. But that won't happen very often. That's going to do it for today's show. Thanks to everyone for listening. If you've yet to subscribe to the Late Round Podcast, make sure you are by searching for it on iTunes, Google Play, SoundCloud, TuneIn, Stitcher, and Spotify. And if you're on iTunes, please leave a rating and review. I'm also on Twitter, @LateRoundQB. You can follow me on there for football data and some bad dad jokes. Thanks, everyone. Have a great weekend.